Hi, my name's Gary King, and I've assembled the most formidable JFK team on planet Earth. We've got Dr. James Fetzer, Larry Rivera, who is the number one researcher in the world today when it comes to new research, and we've got Don Fox, who's not afraid to look a little bit deeper than anyone else. So if you're interested in what happened to the 35th President of the United States, then I invite you to our show. It's called The New JFK Show, and it's on YouTube. Go to Gary King YouTube channel, and we've got over 90 shows archived for you there. So if you really want to know the truth, and knowing that over 9 out of 10 researchers are working the other side of the street in a sea of disinformation, I pledge to you the truth about JFK. Go to Gary King YouTube channel and find out your true history.
This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal.
In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade.
It looks like one of those scenes of an old building being purposely dynamited and blown.
When we are successful,
I'm just a patsy.
And we will be.
Ready to make to come to the microphone, so we'll listen up.
A new world order.
So my name's Robbie Parker.
It might have appeared that way, but from my close-up inspection, there's no evidence of a plane having crashed anywhere near the Pentagon.
Let us never tolerate outrageous conspiracy theories concerning the attacks of September the 11th.
President Kennedy died at 1 p.m.
Live from the Media Broadcasting Center.
This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal, where with the results of Tuesday's mammoth voting, Hillary Clinton carried 5 states, Donald Trump carried 4, Kasich carried Ohio, but where we're on the eve of what is going to be the dirtiest politics in American history, I predict, including especially the demonization of Donald Trump. There's a massive effort already underway to portray him as a new incarnation of Adolf Hitler. I'll explain why there are serious problems with that analogy, but it's going to be played for all it's worth. What's going on here is a titanic struggle, not just for the control of the Republican Party, but for the future of the New World Order. Donald Trump is the greatest threat to have arisen, who represents the potential to undermine the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the North American Free Trade Agreement, and their kin, which place corporations in control of the entire world. That's why this is so big. That's why this is so significant. So here, as you can see on the first slide, the theme that we're going to encounter again and again now until the election is Trump as Hitler. If you go to the second slide, you see that a woman was already photographed wearing a Trump t-shirt, and giving a Sig Heil salute. It turns out this woman is a Bernie Sanders supporter. Her name is Portia Bulger, who runs the Women for Bernie tweeter. So here you got a woman for Bernie giving a Sig Heil wearing a Trump t-shirt, clearly intended to convey in a single image that Donald Trump was responsible for a re-inauguration of fascism in the United States. Wayne Madsen seems to have dug to the bottom of this. In his report for March 14th and 15th, he exposes George Soros' Gene Sharp methods being employed by the anti-Trump protesters, the first paragraph of which reads as follows. The people of Eastern Europe and the Middle East are all too familiar with the street tactics being employed by anti-Donald Trump protesters across the United States. As previously seen on the streets of Europe during highly coordinated and well-planned political demonstrations, anti-Trump protesters in Chicago, Cleveland, St. Louis, Dayton, and other cities appeared before television cameras waving freshly printed protest signs. Such rent-a-mom actions are trademark signs of the involvement of George Soros and the Central Intelligence Agency's godfather of political street violence, Gene Sharp, in disrupting the normal political process. George Soros is a very bad guy. He is a billionaire who has financed disruption and riots in Ukraine. He has financed disruption and riots in Ferguson. He has financed disruption and riots in Chicago. And here his moves have been very clever because he is a financial supporter of MoveOn.org and of Black Lives Matter, where he's pitting Sanders supporters against Trump supporters to promote the Trans-Pacific Partnership and the New World Order. Sanders and Trump both threaten the New World Order, which is why they have been so significant, with Bernie seriously, even mortally wounded, though he has enough money to carry on, but with Hillary firmly in control. This is a very clever move where Sanders has been played. He's been so conned by this that he has not understood that Donald Trump had evidence that Sanders supporters were involved in these attacks, not Sanders himself being a very naive, gullible guy who doesn't realize that his people can be manipulated from behind the scenes by devious persons like George Soros, and who has even resorted to describing Donald Trump as a pathological liar, which is completely absurd. But Sanders believes it. When Trump reports that Sanders people have been involved in creating this disruption, he is speaking on firm ground. When Sanders denies it, it's because he knows no better. Here is a tweet from Donald himself. It's Clinton and Sanders people who disrupted my rally in Chicago. And then they say, I must talk to my people, phony politicians. Donald is on the right side here, where Sanders needs some instructions in the ways of covert operations. He appears to me to be very naive. Here is a blog from the cartoonist who writes Dilbert. He talks about wanting to disavow Scott Adams. It seems I am mostly to blame for the recent scuffles at Trump rallies. I apologize this and for the nuclear annihilation that is likely ahead of us after Trump wins the presidency in a landslide. There will be no nuclear annihilation, of course. Why he resorts to such hyperbole is beyond me, because he has many sensible things to say. Fast forward today, we see the media priming the public to try to kill Trump, or at least create some photogenic mayhem at a public event. Again, no one is sitting in a room plotting Trump's death, or so he believes. But let's be honest, at least half of the media believes Trump is the next Hitler, and a Hitler assassination would be morally justified. Also great for ratings. The media would not be charged with any crime for triggering some nut to act. There would be no smoking gun, no guilt, no repercussions, just better ratings and bonuses all around. In the two-dimensional world of reason, no one in the media consciously wants a candidate for president to be injured, and no one is consciously acting in a way that would make it happen. But in the three-dimensional world of persuasion, society has decided to lance the wart that is Trump. Collectively, the media, the public, and the other candidates are creating a situation that is deeply dangerous for Trump. Is it justified? According to social media and the mainstream media as well, Trump might be the next Hitler because he does things Hitler would have done. For example, Trump is charismatic and appeals to our prejudices. So was Hitler. Trump approves of violence against people he thinks deserve it. So did Hitler. Trump blames others for the nation's problems. So did Hitler. Trump has an authoritarian vibe, as did Adolf. All that is true, but it would be equally easy to build a list of reasons why Trump is definitely not like Hitler. For example, Trump is anti-war. Hitler, not so much. Trump asks us to favor legal citizens over non-citizens. He makes no mention of race. Hitler killed his own citizens and mostly cared about race. Trump wants citizens to be heavily armed to protect themselves against bad people, including dictators. Hitler didn't want to arm his potential enemies and indeed disarm his own people to make them more amenable to control. Trump wants greater freedom of speech. That would include politically incorrect topics. Hitler wasn't so big on free speech for others. Trump assures us his genitalia have no problem. Hitler had only one testicle. I could go on, but you see how easy this is. The mainstream media can either portray Trump as Hitler or as non-Hitler. So far, they have chosen, subconsciously, I assume, the Hitler analogy all the way. Well, as a professor of logic, critical thinking, and scientific reasoning, analogies comparing one thing to another are faulty when there are more differences than there are similarities, or there are few but important differences. In this instance, I think without any doubt, this is a faulty analogy because there are more differences than there are similarities. In particular, the differences enumerated here. Trump is anti-war, wants to favor legal citizens, wants citizens to be heavily armed, wants greater freedom of speech. Those are all major differences from Adolf Hitler, and make it very clear that the Hitler analogy has no basis, or at most only a flimsy one, which can only be defended by ignoring all of their differences. That's like the used car salesman who wants to sell you an automobile by pointing out the luxurious upholstery, the great stereo, and the fact that the air conditioning works well, while ignoring that it needs a ring job and the transmission is shot. You have to look at all of the evidence, which clearly shows Donald Trump is no Adolf Hitler. Now, there's more going on here with exposures about the anti-Trump Chicago riots and those blaming Trump, in this case, in 4 minutes. We're talking about an article by Watson on InfoWars where he identifies 28-year-old Jedediah Brown, who claims to be an ordained pastor and an anti-violence activist. However, the video shows him slugging it out with several others against a man at the Trump rally. Did Mr. Brown not read that elders are to be temperate, self-controlled, respectable, hospitable, not violent, but gentle, not quarrelsome? 1 Timothy 3:2. I'm guessing he didn't and should be removed from any place of authority in the church, as he just demonstrated he is unqualified on many levels. Of course, many Sanders supporters threaten violence for Trump supporters and even wave the communist flag about, which is an ideology that was responsible for the deaths of literally hundreds of millions of people during the 20th century. My goodness, we haven't even seen these people come out yet and call for the assassination of Donald Trump. Yet, I don't see them being arrested. Hint at the FBI, who worked to arrest peaceful protesters and fire on innocent people, along with the Oregon State Police, in the shooting where Levon Fittikum was taken out. Where are you guys in all of this? In fact, I don't see the FBI dealing with known domestic terrorist and close friend of Barack Hussein Obama, Sarato Sobarka, Bill Ayers, who showed up to throw fuel on the fire of the Chicago insurrection. He also quotes many of the commentators on television and other politicians who are seeking to denigrate Trump. Here's Megyn Kelly. Trump's own rhetoric at his rallies, and in particular in some of the violence we have seen at his rallies, some of the violent clashes with protesters who often are African-American, they are really black and weren't born in Africa, has led it fed into what we're seeing here tonight. Rachel Maddow, who in my opinion has shown herself to be particularly shallow on this and a host of other issues, before this rally started, when we saw what happened in the streets outside this event, we saw what Donald Trump had done to incite violence. And I'm saying that deliberately. Of course you are, just as you're deliberately slandering another man for speaking the truth, to incite violence from his event earlier today in St. Louis. Complete rubbish, my opinion. Ted Cruz. But in any campaign, responsibility starts at the top. Any candidate is responsible for the culture of the campaign. You create an environment that only encourages this sort of nasty discord. Remember, Cruz also tried to paint the Patriots in Oregon as aggressors too, rather than understand they were exercising their rights protected under the First and Second Amendments. Marco Rubio, there are real consequences when someone speaks as a presidential candidate or ultimately as president. This comes from little Marco, who thinks it's funny to make penis jokes on national television at his rallies. Let me just add about Rachel. She has shown herself to be ignorant about JFK, about 9/11, about Sandy Hook, about the Boston bombing. She, in my opinion, is as intellectually unqualified to serve as a political commentator as anyone on television today. Here the author continues. I just have one question before I point out that in the article that appeared on InfoWars, some of the things that Watson says in the video, and the question I want you to consider is this. Does anyone else find it coincidental that after so many political elite and donors met with the apparent purpose of dealing with Donald Trump, according to Bill Kristol, just last weekend, that this would flow in its wake? Pardon me while I put two and two together. Now, notice the attacks did not come from those supporting Trump nor Donald Trump himself. They came from agent provocateurs and other leftists. They attacked police, people gathered for the Trump rally, tore up signs, fired guns in the air, threatened to rape women, and basically acted in a manner that takes on the character of an insurrection that should be constitutionally put down by the citizen militia or the police in the performance of their duty. Of course, the media and Bernie Sanders supporters said this was all an act of free speech. I don't know who these people were when peaceful protesters stood against hundreds of armed federal agents at the Bundy Ranch in 2014, where they were when some of those same peaceful protesters stood in Oregon against a D.C. criminal government that usurps its constitutional authority and grabs up land and minerals from the people. Mind you, no threats of violence took place there. There were no guns fired except by federal agents and state police, resulting in the murder of one of those peaceful protesters. No rapes occurred. Are you starting to get the picture, America? Evil has been labeled good, and good has been labeled evil. Even on Facebook, there are Facebook pages calling for the assassination of Donald Trump. And when a complaint was made, a report you can see here, thanking you for anonymously reporting assassinate Donald Trump for containing credible threat of violence, thanks for your feedback. Here's what Facebook wrote. Thank you for taking the time to report something that you feel may violate our community standards. Reports like yours are an important part of making Facebook a safe and welcoming environment. We reviewed the page you reported for having a credible threat of violence and found it doesn't violate our community standards. How outrageous can you get? Well, maybe the reason it doesn't violate their community standards is because it was put there by Mark Zuckerberg, who is the founder and CEO at Facebook. Mark Zuckerberg, who studied computer science at Harvard, lives in Palo Alto. This is completely outrageous and disgraceful. Here is a man who benefits from the public by providing social media, but then abuses it himself by posting a Facebook page calling for the assassination of Donald Trump. And when complaints are issued, he has his own company report that they do not violate the community standards of Facebook. Think about that. Here we have others. In this case, Tiana McHenry. Someone, anyone, assassinate Trump and his offspring. I don't care if this tweet gets me on the FBI watch list. I effing hate that man. Well, this woman appears to be a complete and total moron, but this is a bizarre exercise of free speech. But there's a lot more. Look at this. I just went online to see what we find. Assassinate Trump. Violent threats going unchecked. Russia warns Donald Trump of assassination plot. Trump Twitter. Assassination threats against Donald Trump. Kill Donald Trump. Twitter explodes with violent threats. Romney delivers an assassination threat to Donald Trump. Kill Trump. Enraged left calls for assassination. This is all truly, truly beyond the fringe. This is downright illegal. These are violations of the law. The Secret Service should be all over this. Why? What's going on? Why is everyone going off over the edge, coming unglued? I think because of Hillary's weaknesses. Bear in mind, she supports NAFTA and the Trans-Pacific Partnership. NAFTA was signed by her husband, Bill Clinton. Ross Perot warned us that giant sucking sound was all those jobs going south. NAFTA has already had the effect of gutting the manufacturing and industrial base of the Midwest. This is why Bernie Sanders won in Michigan. Lack of trustworthiness. Hillary has changed her position on the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which would cement corporations in control of the American government. In fact, the TPP creates a transnational board of super warriors that can override the statutes or the laws of any of the nations, 14 in all, including the United States, including our own constitution. In other words, if TPP is passed, we no longer have a sovereign nation. I believe this is one of the reasons why Barack Obama has been so eager to confiscate our weapons. He's worried that Americans, discovering he's sold them out, that we no longer have a constitution because now it can be overridden by this board of lawyers for the Trans-Pacific Partnership. People may be pissed off and come looking for him. Breaches in email security, you may not think that's been a big issue, but it turns out to be enormous. Her involvement in Libya, we came, we saw, he died. She was the principal force bringing about the attack on Libya by NATO. That was a wonderful country. It had an idyllic society where Muammar Gaddafi was providing the necessities of life to the Libyan people, national health care, national public education. They would even take those who had medical problems that couldn't be dealt with in Libya, fly them anywhere in the world in the company of a relative or friend. All expense paid. They had a warehouse, national warehouses. Anyone lacking food could go and be fed. There was virtually no crime in Libya. Then because of Hillary, where Bill Gates, who was the Secretary Gates of Defense at the time, opposed it. Even Barack Obama opposed it, but Hillary pushed for it. They took out Gaddafi, and Libya today is in a state of chaos. It's a breeding ground for terrorists around the world. Facilitating Bill's sexploitation of women and a neocon promoting war with Russia. This is the real Hillary Clinton. She is as much a neocon as Samantha Powers at the United Nations, Victoria Nuland in the Department of State, Ash Carter at the Department of Defense, and Susan Rice, Obama's security aide. Any of you who doubt it, check out The Real Deal, episode 147, Hillary's Benghazi, How the West Described Libya. With Jimmy and Joanne Moriarty, they had come to Libya because they had a new organic process for disposing of organic waste that left no waste whatsoever. It was non-toxic, 100% green methodology. They were there when it happened. They described the gangs coming in, these mercenary armies. They were being paid three times over. First, to kill a person. Second, to chop them up. Third, to burn the bodies. Mass rapes were taking place. Total destruction of Libyan society. They didn't deserve it. Muammar Gaddafi was going to be presented with a humanitarian award by the United Nations the following week. Hillary was behind this. And she has lied about it from beginning to end. In terms of the Clintons' war on women, I featured Roger Stone, where he exposed how Hillary has gone after the women who complained about their sexual abuse at the body of Bill Clinton. He was actually kicked out of Oxford for having raped a fellow student. Hillary went after those women again and again. She facilitated Bill Clinton's exploitation of other women. She is a disgrace. Once American women understand Hillary's role here, I think the attitude is going to change dramatically. And the email case is overwhelmingly more serious. Here's an important article, World Report, on the severity of Hillary's security breaches. The fellow who published this, Bill Still, worked in classified environments on and off since he was 18. He grew up in the D.C. metro area where clearances are as common as ticks on a dog. He knows a lot about it. What you're about to read is very important. It's the most detailed exposition of our national security structure I've ever read. As far as I know, this is exactly how the system works, and everyone in the nation needs to know what is about to happen as a result. Because once the FBI uncorks its probable referral for the indictment of Hillary Clinton, the American public will be subjected to a stream of lying and confusion that even Ted Cruz cannot match. Here's this report from Ed Cowett, a retired U.S. Army intelligence officer. He was chief of the Human Intel Branch for the U.S. European Command in Stuttgart, Germany. He was also the designated program manager for special access program, like the SAP that Hillary Clinton is alleged to have compromised in the most recent State Department Inspector General's report to Congress. Here is what I personally know about SAPs and what I can attest to in an unclassified form. One, the names of each SAP are themselves classified top secret because the information within the SAP are far and above top secret. Two, SAPs are so sensitive that even people who have security clearances, giving them access to top secret sensitive compartmentalized information, an enormously high security clearance level cannot have access to a SAP unless they have a special indoctrination into the SAP based on an operational must-know that exceeds all other need-to-know standards. Two, SAPs are so sensitive, even people who have security clearances giving them access to top secret. That's a repetition. Three, being read into a SAP is far more than acknowledged in writing that you have been briefed on the SAP. It's an in-depth indoctrination to the SAP, where each SAP itself is compartmentalized separately from other SAPs. Having access to one SAP does not give you access to another. Only a tiny handful of people have knowledge of all SAPs. SAPs are the most stringently compartmented and protected information in the entire U.S. government. Four, unlike top secret SCI, which is maintained in highly secure, sensitive, compartmentalized information facilities managed by specially trained security officers at various levels of command, every single SAP is managed by an individually designated program manager for each individual SAP covering an entire theater of operations. SSOs are not cleared to even know about SAPs or to maintain information about them, and they're already enormously secure, sensitive compartment information facilities. How SAPs are secured cannot be discussed because of its top secret nature. Unlike individuals with the highest top secret SCI access security who must undergo, those tiny few who have access to SAPs must also endure periodic polygraph tests in addition to the most comprehensive of special background investigations. I used to have to schedule 4-star generals and admirals to be polygraphed in order for them to maintain their access to my SAP. Many generals and admirals who obviously have the highest security clearances did not rate being indoctrinated into my SAP. In fact, they didn't even know the SAP existed. Six, compromise of a SAP is the single most dangerous security violation that can happen to the USA. Even the enormously damaging revelations of the Edward Snowden top secret SCI security compromise does not reach the level of a SAP compromise. Seven, to put SAP information into an unsecured server, as Hillary Clinton's unsecured server is a class one felony that could, in some cases, result in life in prison. That is because such a compromise is so dangerous that it could and likely will result in the death of people protected by and within the scope of the SAP. As a former SAP program manager, it is inconceivable that if it is verified that Hillary Clinton's server actually had SAP information on it, she could possibly escape indictment and criminal prosecution. As hard as it is to imagine, that would even be worse than electing to not prosecute a mass murdering serial killer, because even they could not inflict as much damage to our country as the compromise of a SAP. Now, anyone who thinks that Hillary is going to come off scot-free over the email business, I think, does not understand the severity, the seriousness of the situation. What then are Donald Trump's strengths? He's anti-NAFTA and anti-TPP. In fact, one of the features of the TPP that's especially onerous is that corporations could undertake projects that involve the violation of local environmental and pollution regulations. And if they're unable to carry out those projects because of those regulations, the entity involved is required to pay them the profits they would have obtained had they been able to go forward with it. He's anti-ISIS, made in the USA. Many drone pilots are leaving the military because Obama will not allow them to attack ISIS. The reason I shall explain is that ISIS was, in fact, made in the USA. His temporary ban on Muslims. There are lots of reasons for that temporary ban, but where the American people, by and large, are supportive. I have an article right here. GOP voters support ban on Muslims. Washington. About two-thirds of Republican primary voters in all five states voting Tuesday support temporarily banning non-citizen Muslims from entering the United States. But majorities in all five say they want immigrants already in the United States illegally to be allowed a chance to stay. Well, with Mexico, he talks about it, having the Mexicans pay. Most Americans don't even realize there's already a wall there. It's just not a very good one. He repudiates the invasion of Iraq, explaining we were lied to make it happen. He rejects the war on terror. He's faulted W, Jeb Bush's brother, for having not protected us, which is a manifest, provable conclusion. There was an article in The Atlantic featuring extensive quotes from George Tenet, then the director of the CIA, and Richard Clark, who was our anti-terrorism czar, about the efforts they made repeatedly to draw the attention of the administration to Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda, which they refused to do. I believe that was because they were going to blame Al-Qaeda and Osama for the event, notwithstanding the facts of the matter, because 9/11 was brought to us, compliments of the CIA, the neocons in the Department of Defense, most of whom had come from the Project for a New American Century, and were dual U.S.-Israeli citizens and the Mossad. The reasons for Americans supporting the ban should be obvious by now. 9/11 was blamed on 19 Muslim terrorists. The Boston bombing was blamed on Muslims. Charlie Hebdo was blamed on Muslims. The Paris attack was blamed on Muslims. San Bernardino was blamed on Muslims. ISIS is the creation of bad Muslims. Iran is run by bad Muslims. Muslim hordes are invading Europe. Conclusions, Muslims are bad. Keep them out of the United States at least temporarily until we can figure out what's going on. Given the propaganda the government has been spreading, demonizing Muslims, how could the American people not be receptive to a temporary ban until we figure out what's taking place? In addition, however, the Donald is wrong about the Iran deal. He seems to believe that the $150 billion we gave to Iran was American taxpayer money. It was not. That was money that was frozen under the sanctions, which themselves to be violations of Article 33 of the Geneva Conventions of 1949. So Donald needs to get up to speed about the Iran deal. Our own intelligence agencies, all 16, concluded by 2007 that Iran was not pursuing nuclear weapons, which they reaffirmed in 2011. Even the Mossad in 2012 concluded Iran was not pursuing nuclear weapons, which they reported to their government 3 weeks before Benjamin Netanyahu went to the United Nations and asserted precisely the opposite. And under Article 33 of the Geneva Conventions, no one may be punished for a crime they did not personally commit. The sanctions are a form of collective punishment that represent war crimes. Donald needs to get on the other side. The Iran deal was not only a good deal, it was relieving the United States for the continued oppression of Iran by collective punishments that qualify as war crimes. Donald needs more homework. He does not seem to appreciate either that ISIS was made in the USA. Those who missed the memo, 9/11 was brought to us by the CIA, the neocons, and the Department of Defense, and the Mossad. Its objective was to transform U.S. foreign policy from one in which we at least officially never attacked any nation that had not attacked us first, to one in which we would become the greatest aggressor nation in the world. Wesley Clark at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco on October 3rd, 2007, revealed that the game plan was to take out the government of seven countries in the next 5 years, beginning with Iraq and Libya, ending with Syria and Iran. Russia has put a halt to it, but it's not for lack of trying. Now that Russia is pulling back its forces, we'll see what develops, but Russia has made it very clear that they are willing to intervene on the side of the Assad government, which was not responsible for the chemical attacks that were brought by the rebels, but blamed on Assad, and where Obama had to back off when the American people were opposed to his lobbing cruise missiles into Syria on that basis. They had to regroup, and the plan they came up with was ISIS, where the Judicial Watch was able to obtain the documents from the Defense Intelligence Agency creating ISIS. We have photographs of ISIS members sporting U.S. Army tattoos. We have videos hacked from the files of Senator John McCain, where ISIS is known in Washington, D.C. as John McCain's army, showing the taping of the fake beheading videos on sound stages in either Tel Aviv or Hollywood. There's much more I have to say about Trump, in quoting Judge Jeanine on Truth versus News. I encourage you to track it down for March 10th. Bernie's situation is fascinating. He's opposed to NAFTA and the TPP. He's for Medicare for all. He opposes wealth inequality. He's a 74-year-old socialist, yet he's been giving Hillary a run for her money. The key, I believe, is his opposition to NAFTA and the TPP. And here, of course, there's an overlap between Bernie and Donald. They both represent outsiders who are opposed to the inside game. They're opposed to the New World Order. Bernie's for Medicare for all. Donald has talked about having individual health insurance plans. I believe Bernie is in the right. And when Donald gets into office, he'll consult with the best experts and recognize that Medicare, which was always designed to be expanded, is the right way to go to have a single payer to reduce costs to the American people. He'll appraise it from a cost-benefit point of view. Now, what's absolutely crucial here is that Bernie's victory showed that NAFTA and the TPP are a very important issue that strike very deeply with American workers, especially blue-collar, the so-called Reagan Democrats who appear to be turning out for Trump in large measure. The question becomes, will Bernie's followers support Donald Trump or stay with Hillary Clinton? In my opinion, the rationale for Bernie's whole effort is far more in common with the Trump movement than with anything to do with Hillary Clinton. Hillary is another representative of the status quo of the corporations of the New World Order. The system, however, is now being rigged. The National Republican Conference is going to adopt the Democratic National Committee rules to stop Trump. This involves basically turning delegates into super delegates who have the right to vote for anyone they want. In other words, they are freeing them up from their obligation to support the candidate they were voted and elected to represent during the first ballot. On Friday, the Republican National Standing Rules Committee informed its membership convention delegates are not bound to the will of the Americans who voted in the primary. And if that's the case, it's very reasonable to ask, what is the point in even having one? The Republican Party establishment elite oligarchy has pulled out loser Mitt Romney in an effort to stump Trump. CNN reported Romney instructed his closest advisors to investigate the possibility of stumping Trump at the convention. His focus centered on preventing Trump from accumulating the 1,237 delegates needed to secure the nomination. It's reported, however, that Mitt has a condition. He is willing to step in and carry the Republican banner in the fall general election as the Republican nominee. But another name has been thrown out as a potential banner carrier, none other than House Speaker Paul Ryan. InfoWars has put it this way. Romney and Ryan did not run in the 2016 primary and are not the choice of primary voters. But this does not matter to the Republican National Committee. The only thing that matters in 2016 is saving the party and the establishment from the dangerous and resented outsider, Donald Trump. In other words, every delegate will be a superdelegate. It's a tactic that has been used by the Democratic Party for years. But think about what's going on here. Donald Trump has motivated the public. Many independents and Democrats are crossing over to vote for the Republican nominee. The Republican Party ought to be aiding and supporting Trump and strengthening their relations to make sure they get more Republicans elected to the Senate and to the House of Representatives to oppose Trump. This far into the nominating process is to commit a form of political suicide. Deborah Wasserman Schultz, the Democratic National Committee chair, admitted in February that the system is rigged, giving plausible deniability by claiming it's for the sake of diversity rather than to have party leaders select the nominee. Unpledged delegates exist really to make sure that party leaders and elected officials don't have to be in a position where they're running against grassroots activists. We are, as a Democratic Party, really highlighting and emphasizing inclusiveness and diversity at our convention, and we want to give opportunity to grassroots activists and diverse committed Democrats to be able to participate, attend, and be a delegate. So we separate out those unpledged delegates to make sure there isn't competition between them. What she's saying is they allow the delegates to come and participate as a soporific in order to pacify them while the party leaders control what actually happens. She further clarifies to make this more pleasant to the politically correct sensitive in the Democratic Party. We separate those so that we don't have elected officials and party leaders running against the activists, but want to make sure are helping to diversify our convention. That's something we take great pride in. A Native American cancer survivor, those people should have an opportunity to be delegates too. And they shouldn't have to deal with very well-known officials and party leaders, and that's why we separate them. But this has nothing to do with diversity or making sure those people have the opportunity to be delegates as well. It's about rigging the system to ensure that establishment Democrats are the ones that wind up running as presidential candidates. A GOP super PAC has just released an attack ad directly comparing Trump to Hitler. This is a new low. Who am I kidding? Every day is a new low in the presidential race of 2016. So you might be wondering if we've all slipped into some magical crazy land with this bizarre level of nonsense going out on a daily basis. But after you watch this new anti-Trump attack ad, the question you might be asking yourself, has Trump broken the GOP? The ad comes from a group called Citizen Super PAC, which claims to be a platform for leveling the playing field by crowdsourcing funding for political ads. The two co-founders, Chris Goober and Ronald Seslow, both have long ties to Republican politics. Goober worked on George W. Bush's 2004 political staff and then the Department of Justice before going to the Republican National Committee in 2006. And starting in 2007, he spent 2 years as general counsel for the National Republican Senatorial Committee, which helps elect Republican senators. Seslow worked as a political coordinator for the National Republican Senatorial Committee from September 2007 to February 2009. He worked on a couple of National Republican campaigns before hopping on board Carly Fiorina's campaign, where he worked until February. Let's watch it now. Let's watch this ad from the Super PAC, GOP Super PAC, directly comparing Hitler with Donald Trump.
Our country doesn't win anymore.
It's a fight for the first demand of
our negotiators' terrible deals.
If I'm elected president,
a total and complete shutdown of Muslims entering the United States.
You have to take out their families.
I'm going to open up our libel laws so we can sue the media.
Should we do the pledge? I swear I'm going to vote for Donald Trump.
defending season.
We will win.
Defense!
We will win.
Defense!
We will win.
Defense!
We're going to make America great again.
Season has shown me the Eisenhower Stadium.
Citizen Super PAC is responsible for the content of this advertising.
Trump is no Hitler. It's a faulty analogy. That doesn't mean that, like a used car salesman, they won't repeat it again and again and again. However, it may not be having the effects intended. Here are some responses to watching this ad. Sergeant Dornan, wow, this ad really opened my eyes. I'm voting for Trump now. Rothbardian barbarian, if they lied about Trump, did they lie about Hitler? Wanton Obex, I don't know about you guys, but after watching this video, I may mean maybe that Hitler dude wasn't so bad after all. Aussie Flynase, wait, so Hitler just cared about his country and his people and didn't want them being used and abused by the same internationalists that are using and abusing countries like our own today? Wow, this really opened my eyes. I'm going to learn more about this Hitler fellow. Augustus Pugin, I thought Hitler was supposed to be a bad guy, but according to this, he just wanted to make his country great like Trump. Wow. Where we lied about him makes you think. The jester mask. I get this is supposed to bash Trump, but honestly, it just makes me want to vote for him. We're in a situation now where the Republican Party is on the verge of committing political suicide. Donald Trump is bringing millions of new voters in. They ought to be ecstatic about it. They're so desirous of controlling the party in the future and standing up for the new world order that the Republican Party is willing to take a dive to trash the party to elect Hillary Clinton, who, after all, has the great virtue of standing for the new world order, the TPP and NAFTA. And let me just add here a crucial consideration about her lack of trustworthiness and honesty. Hillary originally supported the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which would further vitiate the sovereignty of the United States. Now she claims she is against it, but her lack of trustworthiness and honesty is so high, no one believes her. I don't think this is going to give her an out. She stands for the TPP. She stands for the New World Order, just as she stood for NAFTA, which has gutted the industrial and manufacturing base of the United States. Hillary is bad for the USA. Donald Trump, however, promises to make America great again. Think about it. These are all the alternatives. We're entering the nastiest period in American political history, so I predict. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal. Stand by for the new JFK show with Gary King. For my final response to Jim DiEugenio's attacks from Sitka, we'll be right back.
Less than 3% of you people read books, because less than 15% of you read newspapers. Right now, there is a whole, an entire generation that never knew anything that didn't come out of this tube. This tube can make or break presidents, popes, prime ministers. Television is not the truth. Television is a circus, a carnival, a traveling troupe of acrobats, storytellers, dancers, singers, jugglers, sideshow freaks, lion tamers, and football players. We deal in illusions, man. None of it is true. But you people sit there day after day, night after night, all ages, colors, creeds.
Broadcasting live on network radio.
So turn off your television sets. Turn them off now. Turn them off and leave them off.
Say with moral certainty and considerable scientific authority that the death of JFK was committed by a meticulously executed conspiracy which was obscured by an extensive cover-up.
Murder in Dealey Plaza, edited by James Fetzer, goes to the heart of the JFK assassination. You'll read new and up-to-date information regarding the Secret Service, the Lincoln limousine, the medical evidence, the cover-up, altering the film, framing the patsy, and the silent historians. Also, 16 smoking guns, each one crushing the government's lone assassin scenario. A world-class chronology of November 22, 1963. Chapters by David W. Mantic, Gary Aguilar, Vincent Palomara, Douglas Weldon, Jack White, Ira David Wood III, James H. Fetzer, Doug Horn, and a classic essay by Bertrand Russell. The complete story in the pages of one single book, edited by James H. Fetzer. Read it now. Read it again. You'll use it as a reference. Murder in Dealey Plaza. Available at Amazon.com and major bookstores around the world. It's murder.
This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal.
In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade.
It looks like one of those scenes of an old building being purposely dynamited and blown.
When we are successful,
I'm just a patsy.
And we will be.
You're ready to make to come to the microphone, so we'll listen up.
A new world order.
So my name's Robbie Parker.
It might have appeared that way, but from my close-up inspection, there's no evidence of a plane having crashed anywhere near the Pentagon.
Let us never tolerate outrageous conspiracy theories concerning the attacks of September the 11th.
President Kennedy died at 1 p.m.
Live from the Media Broadcasting Center.
Welcome to the new JFK show number 96, where Jim Fetzer, in his final round with Jim DiEugenio, he's been responding to an article that's posted on CITCA, the Citizens for the Truth About the Kennedy Assassination. We do feel there is a fraud amongst us, and we want you to decide. Now, Dr. Fetzer, I'm going to use a boxing analogy. It's really getting bad. I mean, this guy's been cut. He's bleeding on one side of the face. I mean, just go ahead and knock him out, Dr. Fetzer. I mean, do him a favor. It's really getting bad, and I expect an early round TKO. So let's go ahead and ring the bell.
Gary, if this were an actual fight, I think that the referees would have called it long ago. Gary, begin by showing that he's dealing with a real target. This is not just an imaginary figure. This is a substantial, accomplished scholar who's published many books. Here is the part two of The Decline and Fall of Jim Fetzer, which he published on Sitka January 30th, 2016. And this should be the final installment. Gary, would you like to read the critique to which I'll be responding immediately?
All right, here's Jim DiEugenio, and I quote, "What has been Fetzer's reaction to all these people turning their backs on him? He has doubled down on his extremism. He now says that the deaths at Sandy Hook were part of a FEMA exercise. In other words, no one actually died. It was part of a plot to further gun control in America. What about the Boston bombing? Was that faked also?"
Well, the fact is, Gary, that I changed my mind because nobody died at Sandy Hook. It was a FEMA exercise. We even have the manual. Last time I went through it, let me give some of the evidence about Boston to make it equally obvious that this was a contrived event, including amputee actors, believe it or not. We have a video where you can hear the police on bullhorns calling out, "This is a drill. This is a drill." So it's evident the police knew what was going on. We have two tweets from the Boston Globe. One saying, "Breaking news, police will have controlled explosion on 600 block on Boylston Street." And a second, "Officials, there will be a controlled explosion opposite the library within 1 minute as part of bomb squad activities." And lo and behold, 1 minute later, an explosion takes place at the Boston Marathon opposite the Boston Public Library. And a second explosion takes place further down the street. Now, as a former Marine Corps artillery officer, I must observe these appear to be puff bombs. They add smoke and noise, but no significant explosive force. I doubt that anyone could have been actually seriously injured, much less killed by either of these explosions. Notice, by the way, all these police wearing lime green vests, which I believe that means they're participating in a special activity. They are probably off-duty police who are hired to play these roles. Here's a particularly telling photograph. When you peer through the smoke, you see there are bodies, some of whom are missing body parts. But notice what is missing. There is no blood. Lorraine Day, who was for 25 years the head of trauma surgery at San Francisco General Hospital, observed, "This is a physiological impossibility. If anyone had had their limbs blown off at the Boston bombing, there would have been blood all over the place." Interestingly, if you look on the left-hand side, this is a particularly important figure by the name of Jeff Bauman. There's a man in a hoodie who's helping to attach a bone extension, a phony bone extension, to make the effects of the bombing appear all the more graphic. A point to which I shall return. Here you have, again, it's taking place. Notice on the left, you can see that bone extension. He has his leg up above a black woman's head, but there is no blood. If this had been real, there would have been blood spurting out from his arteries, but there is no blood. Further, still, no blood on the right-hand side. Blood only starts showing up later. And when it does, it's fake blood. It's too bright. It's bright reddish orange and it never changes color. Real blood deoxygenates and turns dark red, as you see in the sample of real blood from the bomb in Cairo. Here you can see particularly clearly the false bone extension that's been attached to the leg of the man, Jeff Bauman, who does not appear to be in pain, but rather seems to concern to keep his head off of the pavement. Where people walk, it's dirty and people spit on the pavement, so he doesn't want his head to be resting there. Nathan Foulkes, who is a Hollywood producer-director, identified one of the key players at the Boston bombing, a tall fellow wearing a cowboy hat, as Carlos Arredondo, who was an actor he had cast in one of his own films. He also explained that those appeared to be puff bombs, demonstration bombs, and most strikingly to me, because no one had suggested this to me before, that it was done using a smoke machine rather than a real bombs. And indeed, we have discovered the smoke machine that was used to produce the smoke. It's in a photograph so striking that I put it on the back cover of the book, and nobody died in Boston either, to which I gave the subtitle, State-Sponsored Terrorism with Hollywood Special Effects. We have the fake blood, we have the smoke machine, and we have amputee actors. Here is Carlos Arredondo in the center holding a rag that's supposed to serve as a tourniquet, where Jeff Bauman is put in a wheelchair and rushed away. Now, with a patient with injuries of this kind, where his legs were blown off below the knee, it's most important to keep the patient on the horizontal and to apply tourniquets, because the bleeding out from this kind of injury will render you unconscious in 5 minutes, dead in 10. It can happen very fast. The last thing you do would be to put him in a wheelchair where gravity would help the flow of blood. In fact, in this case, the vibrations from the wheelchair was so great that the false prosthesis fell off, and they had to stop and reconnect the prosthesis. Most embarrassing. I had a very interesting interview with Dr. Stan Monteith, who is himself an orthopedic surgeon who had performed surgeries like this. And he told me that it takes like 3 months minimum to recover from the surgery, and then another 3 months to get around learn to get around without your legs. This is supposed to be Jeff Bauman, but it appears to be somebody completely different. He is in a wheelchair, but the face doesn't look the same. And notice now his legs have been cut off above the knee, above the knee. So this is clearly someone else. In fact, after our conversation, Dr. Stan reported that, and in an article, a column he wrote about it, that he was forced to conclude that this young man was an actor. And indeed, we have the actor waiver form for Homeland Security exercise and evaluation programs. You have to wear a bathing suit, shorts, t-shirt, bring a change of clothes and a towel. Recommended you don't wear jewelry and so forth. FEMA is using actors all over the country. In the case of San Bernardino, for example, we even discovered the Craigslist ad for extras in that event, where it advertised good pay, transportation and food, and some speaking roles. This is the reason why so many were milling around, seemingly not knowing what to do. They didn't know what to do because they weren't trained paramedics. They weren't EMTs. They were simply extras that had been hired through Craigslist. Here, the alternative media actually cracked the case the evening of the Boston bombing by discovering these Kraft International personnel who are wearing khaki trousers, black jackets, and black baseball caps with a skull insignia where the motto of Kraft is, violence does solve problems. Notice on the left, you have Kraft International personnel wearing black nylon backpacks. Notice in particular the black nylon backpack with a white square on it. In the FBI investigation of Boston, they reported that the two backpacks that had exploded were black nylon backpacks. And in the indictment for Zocher Saranov, the younger brother, it stated that the backpacks that exploded were black nylon backpacks. Well, here you have one of the backpacks that exploded. It's a black nylon backpack. It had the white square. Here you see an international Kraft International employee wearing a black nylon backpack with a white square. Below, you see him rushing away, no longer with his backpack. Some of this is so obvious and simple, but get this. Here we have photographs that were provided by the government of the brothers at the marathon. Neither of them, notice, is wearing a black nylon backpack. I asked Remington Graham, a retired professor of law, what he thought was the most compelling of all the evidence we'd amassed about the Boston bombing. And he said the discrepancy in the backpack, it was like at the OJ trial, if the glove doesn't fit, you must acquit, where the defense team made sure the glove wouldn't fit by having OJ put on latex gloves before he applied the skin-tight gloves that would have fit exactly, but for the latex. In this case, they really botched it because this is a staged photograph, and yet neither of the brothers is wearing a black nylon backpack. John Remington Graham explained to me that because the backpacks did not match, there wasn't even probable cause for an arrest, much less an indictment or a conviction in Boston, and yet that's precisely what took place. Joker, the younger brother, was arrested and put on trial and convicted when he didn't even have a black nylon backpack. That gives you an indication of the level of corruption of the judiciary in Boston. Because the alternative media had been so successful in cracking the case, the FBI set out a stooge on Thursday who said, don't look at any of those other photographs, only look at these two. And he presented photographs of the two brothers, Zocher on the left and Tamerlan, his older brother, on the right. I had a conversation and exchanges with Marat Saranova, who was the brother's aunt, who explained to me that these photographs had been photoshopped, and I asked, could she prove it? And she began sending me one photograph after another, where the key point is that in this image, Tamerlan is clean-shaven, but in fact, he had a beard. She sent me photographs of Tamerlan in bed with his cat. He has a beard. She sent me a link to a workout at a gymnasium with his brother. He had a beard. She told me the story of a friend who had called Tamerlan, relieved to find he was nowhere in the vicinity where they had dinner together that night, had a beard. There are convenience photographs from the search where Zucker's inside Tamerlan out. He has a beard. There's the arrest photograph of him where he was ordered to strip naked and put in a police vehicle. He had a beard. Even the death photograph, the photograph of his body, showed him still having a beard. Now, according to the FBI and its media, the brothers were the suspects, one of whom died in police custody, but the others were supposed to be ignored. When he put out the photographs of the brothers, by the way, the FBI agent asked for the help of the public in identifying them because they needed the public's help, but it turned out that they had had the two brothers under surveillance for at least 5 years. This was complete duplicity from beginning to end. The police knew it was a drill. The Boston Globe knew it was a drill. The FBI knew it was a drill. The judge, the prosecutor, only the jurors did not know it was a drill. As they say here, you can't make this stuff up. There's the book, State-Sponsored Terrorism with Hollywood Special Effects. There was noise and smoke, but there was no blood, which is physiologically impossible. The blood only started showing up later. It was fake blood, Hollywood blood, and the smoke came out of a machine. It's really fascinating that only, as retired professor of law John Remington Graham has observed, this means there was not even probable cause for an arrest or an indictment, much less a conviction at trial. Only Russia Today got it right. Notice there on the back, I have a photograph of the smoke machine on the left and of the bombers in the backpack that exploded, where you see the two brothers are not wearing the backpack. Only Russia Today got it right. There are, again, a dozen contributors here, including six PhDs and three JDs, who include John W. Whitehead, JD, and Paul Craig Roberts, PhD, whom I regard as our nation's leading public intellectual. The situation is completely stunning. Those who set the bombs were Kraft International personnel. Everybody knew. The Boston Police knew. The Boston Globe knew. The attorneys knew. Why not the American people? You aren't going to like what you read here. Gary, here's the next complaint.
All right. Before I read that, I just want to say that how much credibility you can lose by saying that that we're wrong about Sandy Hook and about Boston Marathon. It's just devastating. All right. So need more? The last is the anthology?
Yes.
Yeah, the last anthology Fesser edited is called "And I Suppose We Didn't Go to the Moon Either." His co-editor was someone named Mike Palachek. This book centers around three topics. Number one, the USA never went to the moon. Two, Beatle Paul McCartney died decades ago and was substituted. Three, the Holocaust was a myth. If you can't believe it, and you sure as heck can by now, in the section of the book on the last topic, Fetcher allows infamous Holocaust denier Robert
Farrison,
yeah, to contribute an essay. Who's next, Jim? How about David Irving? Farrison actually wrote an essay saying that the diary of Anne Frank was a forgery. In fact, an article Fetcher wrote about the Sandy Hook tragedy is entitled, Did Mossad Death Squad Slaughter American Children at Sandy Hook? So in this piece, written relatively soon after the tragedy, Fetcher seemed to think that people actually perished, but not for long. All right, go ahead, Dr. Fetcher.
Well, the fact is that Diogenio doesn't seem to understand the importance of evidence and truth. It's clear to me he's never studied the moon landing. He's never studied Paul McCartney. He's never studied the Holocaust. And when I discover that there is evidence that's contrary to my previously adopted position, I reject the belief I previously held and accept one I had previously rejected in order to maintain the rationality of my position. It's evident here and elsewhere that that is not the approach of Jim DiEugenio. Paul McCartney appears to have died in an automobile accident already on 9/11/1966. How's that for a coincidence? We have lots and lots of proof that his replacement was a very talented musician. Some would argue even more talented than Paul, but he had a different look. On the left, you see Paul, his replacement. On the right, the original James Paul McCartney. Paul had a longer face. He had different ears. He had a different look about him. There are many other differences. Two Italian forensic scientists sought to disprove the hypothesis they were two different persons and wound up confirming it. This is from their article in Wired Italia. On the right, you can see James Paul McCartney had bad teeth and a small palate, whereas his replacement, who is typically referred to as Fall, F-A-U-L, for false or fake Paul, had good teeth and a normal palate. Here from the side, their profiles are clearly quite different. At the top is Fall. At the bottom is Paul. They had different earlobes. Paul's were attached. Paul's were not. Here is a photograph of Paul McCartney with Jane Asher, to whom he was engaged, and Fall with Jane Asher. What could be more obvious than that Fall is considerably taller than Jane, whereas Paul and Jane were approximately the same height. In the Beatles album, Sgt. Pepper, which was produced after Paul's death and intended to memorialize him, notice you have a gravesite with a left-handed bass guitar. Paul played left-handed. You have the original Beatles in dark at the left. Notice they're all about the same height, but now you have the resplendent new Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band introducing the one and only Billy Shears. The name of the musician who replaced him appears to have been Billy Shepherd, but they also use the name Shears, so they were being very open about it. It was Billy Shears replacing Paul McCartney. It would become a subject of great speculation by Beatles fans. But there's simply no doubt that we're talking about two different people before and after 9/11, 1966. And if DiEugenio would only conduct some research on his own into these subjects, where he attacks me based upon his ignorance, he might appreciate the importance of what is being reported in works of this kind. Here's a nice comparison of the two that shows very clear. Paul on the left, Paul on the right. These are two different persons. As far as the Holocaust narrative is concerned, I was myself fairly astonished to discover that the core of the official narrative, namely that 6 million Jews were put to death in gas chambers at these death camps using Zyklon B, turns out to be hopelessly indefensible. It's simply not true. None of it is true. Let me explain. It turns out there were 236 references to 6 million Jews in dire straits or fear of loss of their life prior to the Nuremberg tribunals. This does not have an empirical basis. 6 million Jews did not die. The International Committee of the Red Cross was visiting all of these camps and keeping very meticulous records about who died, their race, their origin, their nationality, how they died. They found not a single death from being put to death in gas chambers. And in 1993, they updated their records to show that a total of 296,081 had died in all the camps combined. That's a small fraction of the 6 million, and none of them died from gas chambers. In fact, the whole 6 million appears to be derivative of a disputed passage in Leviticus, which claims that the chosen people will return to the promised land only when they're minus 6 million who have been consumed in the flames. But even that requires an interpolation because there was no word or symbol in Hebrew for 6 million. Nevertheless, this is indicative that it wasn't an empirical or a scientific result, about which I will explain more later. The Allied massive bombing of the German cities reduced them to rubble and in the process interdicted the railroad lines that were being used to resupply the camps with food and provisions. These camps were located in the vicinity of major military installations such as armaments factories, and they were using them as slave labor to keep the German military machine on the march. You can't get work out of a corpse. It turns out that Zyklon B interacts with the walls of chambers to turn them blue, as shown here. But the only chambers that turned blue were those that were used for delousing, where Zyklon B was being used in copious quantity to kill body lice to prevent this spread of diseases like typhus and dysentery. In other words, to keep the inmates healthy. So we have these massive stacks of bodies, many of which did occur from starvation at the end of the war, but which were not from the systematic genocide of millions of Jews in gas chambers. In fact, Nick Kohlerstrom has explained that because Zyklon B is a form of cyanide, it would turn bodies pink. But we have no reports of pink bodies. And the only chambers that turned blue, as I've already observed, were those for the chambers where it was used for delousing. A fellow by the name of Fred Lochter, by the way, gave testimony decades and decades ago that none of the facilities that were claimed to have functioned as gas chambers were suitable for that purpose, that there were too many design defects, that it would have been hopeless to believe that they were actually used for that purpose. Not only has Robert Forreson published brilliant work on this subject, but he published a fascinating study for the Institute for Historical Review about the Zundel trials of 1985 and 1988, where Ernst Zundel was a Canadian citizen who denied that 6 million had died in gas chambers during the Holocaust. He was placed on trial, and the prosecution was unable to produce even one witness to testify that they had seen any of the inmates of those camps put to death by means of a gas chamber. It did not happen. So if Jim DiEugenio wants to continue to believe things that are myths, he's welcome to do it. But anyone with a more serious mental disposition who wants to get to the truth of the matter ought to do some research. The book, And I Suppose We Didn't Go to the Moon Either, is an excellent place to begin. You look at the top left. I was so struck by a photograph I discovered in Nick's book, Breaking the Spell, which is a completely brilliant exposition about the mythology of the Holocaust, of the British soccer team at Auschwitz, that I put it at the back of the book, right at the very top. They're an excellent collection of contributors. Once again, I highly recommend this book, where I will leave the proof we adduce that we didn't go to the moon as an exercise for those who want to pursue that issue. This is the right place to go.
All right. Jim Fetzer begins with his post-academic career in the JFK case, on which he once produced some passable work. But there may be a hint as to why he ended up in the toxic pond. In an interview we did in 2006 with journalist Mike Mosdale, is referring to his three JFK edited anthologies. Fetcher said the following: "These books I have published are the most important in establishing the objective and scientific evidence of those existence of conspiracy, of those existence of a conspiracy. And the cover-up of the assassination of JFK, bar none, no other books come close, remotely none. They are in a category by themselves." Italics added. All right. What to make of such a man? Does he really believe the likes of Sylvia Manger?
Mark.
And John Newman and...
Gayton.
Yeah, Gayton Fonzie should not even breathe in the same air that he does? Does he say this in their defense? Sylvia would not even enter the same building with the likes of John Hankey and Phil Nelson, and she would consider Fesser's association with them enough to consider him persona non grata? So in addition to his lax critical standards and his taste for the sensational, Fesser appears to be afflicted with a streak of megalomania
about
in the JFK field.
Well, this is all completely ridiculous. No other books do come remotely close to these books. As Vincent Bugliosi observed, these are the only three exclusively scientific books to ever be published about the assassination. They are in a category by themselves. They establish, for example, in Assassination Science, that the autopsy x-rays in the National Archives were altered to impose a patch over a massive blowout at the back of the head in the instance of the lateral cranial x-ray, that a 6.5 metallic object had been added to the anterior posterior x-ray to create a linkage to an obscure Mamluker Carcano World War II Italian weapon known as the humanitarian rifle in World War II, that there was evidence of a second shot to the head, that the brain shown in diagrams and photographs in the National Archives can't possibly be the brain of JFK, that all in Assassination Science, together with diagrams by Chuck Crenshaw of the throat wound as a small puncture wound, and the incision, a simple straight lateral incision, and of the blowout, a fist-sized blowout at the back of the head, which he showed from the rear and from the side, an enormous blowout at the back of the head, plus the official JFK, the official Bethesda autopsy report shows this, when you measure the dimensions, this massive blowout at the back of the head, where Commander Humes, it turns out we now know from the further work of the Assassination Records Review Board, but did not know then, had taken a cranial saw to the skull of JFK and greatly enlarged it. David Lifton, in his brilliant book, Best Evidence, was the first to put his finger on the problem there, and he has turned out to be correct. Murder in Dealey Plaza, his three masterful essays by David Manick, including a synthesis of the medical evidence that's among the most brilliant articles I've ever read on any subject in my life. He has a wonderful essay about the Zapruder film and an excellent essay on the silence of the historians and why they aren't speaking out. There are two essays contributed by Doug Horn based upon his research as a senior analyst for military records for the Assassination Records Review Board. Two chapters by Vince Palomara, one about the mass of witnesses who reported seeing the limousine come to a stop in Dealey Plaza, or dramatically slow, and where Doug Weldon has a marvelous chapter about the bullet through the windshield, how the vehicle was taken back to Ford Motor Company and broken down to bare metal and completely rebuilt from the ground up, including replacing the windshield, and a chapter by Gary Aguilar, which ironically Josiah Thompson cited as the only worthwhile chapter in the book, but since Aguilar is documenting the fist-sized hole, the continuity and descriptions from witnesses in Dealey Plaza to Parkland Hospital and on to Bethesda, if Gary Aguilar is right, then the Zapruder film, which does not show it in most of its frames, must have been altered to paint it out. Josiah Thompson wants to maintain at one and the same time that Gary Aguilar is right about the blowout to the back of the head, but that the Zapruder film is authentic in spite of the fact that it does not show it, where in the third of the three, I produced frame 374, where you can clearly see the blowout, compared it to the diagrams by David Manick showing the area P at the back of the head, where the skull had been patched. We have brilliant contributions by David Healy about the use of optical printing and special effects that were available at the time, by Jack White documenting his history of research on the photographs and films related to Lee Harvey Oswald in particular, John P. Costello's masterpiece about the fabrication of the Zapruder film, where every frame had to be reshot because of the existence of the ghost panels that link one frame to another. If those ghost panels were allowed to stand, it would have been obvious that the frames were not consecutive, so they had to be reshot in a laboratory, which is why he describes the film as a complete fabrication. We know now, of course, much more, because Larry Rivera has recovered the interviews that Fred Newcomb did with the JFK motorcycle officers, all of whom confirmed the limo stop, and where we now know it was much more elaborate than we heretofore supposed, that after William Greer brought the limousine to a halt and JFK was hit twice, once in the head from behind where he slumped forward. Jackie eased him back up and was peering right in the face when he was hit in the right temple by a frangible exploding bullet that was fired from the intersection of the triple underpass and the picket fence that blew his brains out the back with such force that when they impacted with Officer Hargis riding there, he initially thought he himself had been shot. Not only did Clint Hill rush forward, push Jackie back where she had climbed out on the trunk to go after a big chunk of JFK's skull and brains, but that and laid across her body, being the first other than Jackie to peer into this fist-sized hole at the back of the head, which is described vividly even in the Kennedy detail about the Secret Service behavior in Dealey Plaza, but that Officer Hargis dismounted his bicycle, ran between the two limousines toward the grassy knoll from which the shots had been fired, that Officer Jackson on the right motored his bike up the grassy knoll until it fell over, that five Secret Service agents dismounted from the Secret Service limousine and surrounded the presidential, one of whom took a piece of bone from a little boy and threw it in the back seat, which has required that I reassess my estimate of the duration of the limousine stop, which I initially thought might have been only 6 or 8 seconds, but where I cannot imagine all these activities taking place in less than 20 or 30. We have proven all this in other programs here on the new JFK show. And for those who want to check out especially what Larry has done, check out the four JFK horsemen on YouTube in the four JFK horsemen part two. It's absolutely stunning stuff. So I reaffirm, no other books come close remotely, none. They're in a category by themselves. And I must add that when I made that remark to Mike Mosdale, I realized that it could be taken out of context and misrepresented as Jim DiEugenio has done here. I pointed out to Mosdale at the time that I can say that because I'm building these books on the shoulders of giants like David Mantic, like Bob Livingston, like Charles Crenshaw, like Jack White, like John P. Costella, like Douglas Weldon, like Doug Horn, Vince Palomara, David Healy, John P. Costella. I mean, these are anthologies. So how could DiEugenio be so naive? I'm not talking about a single authored work. I'm talking about collections where I brought the best experts on different aspects of the case together. And they categorically are all by themselves, as even Vincent Bugliosi acknowledged when he observed these are the only JFK books that are exclusively ever published on the assassination that are exclusively scientific. Sylvia Marr, John Newton, Gayton Fonzie did good work, but it was not objective scientific work on the medical evidence. That's what we brought to the table. And while whatever he may make up about what Sylvia Marr would or would not have shot about thought about the likes of John Hankey and Phil Nelson, there can be no doubt, given the evidence I've already adduced, that Phil Nelson is absolutely correct when he fingers Lyndon Baines Johnson as a pivotal player in the assassination of JFK for all the reasons I previously enumerated, and where Robert Hooke has substantiated John Hankey's position about George Herbert Walker Bush having played a key role in his own publication entitled Did George H.W. Bush Coordinate a JFK Hit Team, to which the answer is emphatically affirmative. Yes, he did. And what's wrong with my associations? I mean, this is a guy who just trades in ad hominems. He doesn't know his homework. He hasn't done his research. He doesn't know anything about Paul McCartney. He doesn't know anything about the Holocaust. More stunningly, he doesn't even know his own work on JFK. That's his subject of area of specialization. He doesn't even know JFK, where he claims to be an authority on the work of Jim Garrison, but never mentioned that Jim Garrison, like so many other experts before him, believed that Lee Oswald was caught in the doorway in the Alton's photograph, which we have proven here again and again and again. Go back and review the evidence. DiEugenio is wrong on every single count. I have yet to find one where he actually both knows what he's talking about and makes a bona fide, legitimate criticism that he can substantiate. He did not even know my position on Gregory Douglass, for God's sake, when I published a revision of my review within 48 hours of my initial impression. He doesn't understand my work on Sandy Hook. I'm certain he's never read the book. So he cites the first of what would turn out to be 30 articles I published on Sandy Hook because he finds the first useful to smear me. That's the level of research he represents, the personal attack, the personal smear, unfounded by serious research and evidence. Here, for example, is David Mantic. Is Jim DiEugenio thereby impugning the work of David Mantic, which is manifest throughout my books? This is the man who is the leading expert on the medical evidence in the world today. And when he most recently published a book on the JFK skull x-rays, whom did he feature to write the preface? Let me give you a clue. It wasn't Jim DiEugenio. So Mantic's work was brought to the public by the books I have edited and has made a monumental contribution. I know no one in the JFK research community who disputes Mantic's credentials, his qualifications, and his accomplishment. Another was Bob Livingston, world authority on the human brain, expert on wound ballistics. As I mentioned before, I know what I do not know. I don't know the interpretation of x-rays. I don't know wound ballistics. But through the collaboration with Bob Livingston, we were able to establish multiple points, several of which I have made today, but including that the brain shown in the diagrams and photographs in the National Archives cannot possibly be that of JFK, already an assassination science. Here's another, Chuck Crenshaw, who was actually present in trauma room number one when JFK's moribund body was brought in and was the last to observe him when his body was prepared to be wrapped in sheets and placed into the blonde ceremonial casket. He actually closed JFK's eyes. He gave me diagrams of the wound before and after, diagrams of the brain wound, the back of the head wound before and after. He appeared on a television program explaining that the blood at the back of the head had been caused by a tangential wound that had entered in the vicinity of the right temple and blown out the back of his head. I would compare DiEugenio unfavorably with any of these individuals. I mean, he's not equal to any of them. He has made no significant contribution of the magnitude they have contributed. And that is also true in relation to Jack White, who kept a generation of students busy studying the photographs and films. He was among the very first to observe that the backyard photographs showing a figure that purports to be Lee Oswald and four or more different positions had exactly the same face. It was just as Lee Oswald observed, his face pasted on somebody else's body. He adduced many proofs and testified before the House Select Committee that the photographs had been fraudulently composed, that the jaw was not Lee Oswald's jaw, which was a pointed jaw, but a block jaw, that there was an insert line between the block jaw and the lower lip, that it was, as Lee claimed, his face pasted on someone else's body, that the fingertips holding the newspapers, the militant and the worker, were cut off, that the militant and the worker themselves constituted an internal yardstick because their dimensions were known. And when you lay it off as an internal ruler, it turns out the man in the photograph is only 4'6". Whereas we knew independently that 5'6", whereas we know independently Lee was 5'10", which meant that either they used someone who was too short to impersonate Lee Oswald, or more clearly that when they fabricated the photographs, they put the newspapers in too large, which yielded the result that if used as an internal yardstick, it would show the figure to be too short to be Lee Oswald. DiEugenio does not have all of his contributions combined as significant as that single proof from Jack White that the backyard photographs were fake. And, of course, John P. Costella, who's proven to be a godsend. Costella and I co-edit an online journal for the advanced study of the death of JFK at assassinationresearch.com, where he put together a masterful compilation of the eyewitnesses on Elm Street, what they had to say that goes on for in excess of 115 pages. And where if you were to simply read through John Costello's compilation of the eyewitness testimony about what happened in Dealey Plaza, you would have a better understanding of events than you'll get from the vast majority of students of JFK who haven't bothered to do their homework. Costello, of course, provided an absolutely brilliant tutorial giving one scientific proof of another of how the contemporarily available Zapruder film had been altered in different ways, including that the blood spray had been painted in and that the blob was an artifact to create the impression of brains blowing out to the right front. These are all magnificent students of JFK, far above the level with which Jim DiEugenio is accustomed to dealing. Gary?
All right. Today, far from being a Fonzie, our mayor, it is more appropriate to look upon Fetzer as a Jeff Rentz or Tom Floco, that is, in repository for junk science and half-baked conspiracy fantasies. I can't even call them theories. Is he aware of how many times NASA actually went to the moon? But he still travels on, stealing for his own omnipotence in the field. In 2013, at a 50th anniversary of the Kennedy murder, he sponsored a conference in Santa Barbara. In an interview with the unsuspecting local alternative media, he stated that there were anywhere from 8 to 10 shots fired at JFK. He then named 6 different locations which they were fired. He then topped that. He now reeled off 6 different assassins which shots they were responsible for. Santa Barbara Independent, 11-20-13. Needless to say, Hankey and Nelson were part of this conference. Thankfully, the reporter did not ask Fetzer about the moon landings.
Well, DiEugenio doesn't know anything about the moon landings. It's obvious to me he's never read the book. So he's talking about research where he's completely and abysmally ignorant. But he loves to trade in ad hominems. As far as identifying the assassins, I thought that was part of the project. I thought that was part of the game plan. Aren't we supposed to figure out who is responsible and why, how it was done from the top to the bottom, including the sponsors who turn out to have included the CIA, the Joint Chiefs, the Mafia, the anti-Castro Cubans, the Eastern establishment surrounding the Fed, the Texas oilmen, and the Mossad? Does he not believe we should expose who were the coordinators and supervisors of the hitmen in Dealey Plaza? Isn't that part of our task, of our responsibility? Aren't we supposed to determine who facilitated the assassination, the roles they played? To read DiEugenio, you'd think he was faulting me for undertaking the task, which I would have assumed was obvious to us all, was a necessary condition for carrying progress on understanding the assassination forward. As our work established, JFK appears to have been hit 4 times or even 5, once in the throat from in front, which we've now established was actually fired from inside the triple underpass, not from outside of the south end of the triple underpass at the above ground sewer opening. About that, new evidence has led to our revising our opinion. Once in the back, that was fired from the county records building, implanting a Mannlicher Carcano in the back of JFK, twice in the head, once from behind from the Dow Techs, where 3 shots were fired with 2 misses and 1 hit, an indication of the unreliability of the weapon. When one of those bullets missed altogether and injured a distant bystander by the name of James Haig, the shots to his throat and right temple appear to have been fired from above ground level sewer openings on the south and north sides of the triple underpass. I believe that at the time I wrote that originally for a national conference on JFK held at the University of North Dakota, where Judge John Thunheim who was the head of the Assassination Records Review Board, introduced me, and where Theodore Sorensen, JFK's principal speech writer, was the keynote speaker, because that shot, it now appears, was fired from inside of the Triple Underpass. So aren't we supposed to know what happened? Here's the big picture. I would have thought this was what we were after. This is an extension of Richard Sprague's original Publishing Computers and Automation, May 1970, based upon additional research, where you can see the green shots emanating from the top of the county records building, one of which was fired and hit JFK in the back, 5.5 inches below the collar, just to the right of the spinal column, only went in about as far as a second knuckle on your little finger, with no point of exit. And where a second shot from the county records building appears to have been fired to have created a crease in the concrete in the vicinity of a manhole cover, for which there's a photograph in Robert Grodin's book, The Killing of a President. Then down at the lower left, you can see the wrong location for the blue line, which passed through the windshield. That should be moved upward and over into the Triple Underpass, which is a much better location, as Gary Rivera and I have previously reported, where the mortician who spent more time with the body than anyone else reported that when he sought to embalm the body, that formaldehyde was leaking through two little incisions in the face, which David Manick brilliantly inferred were caused by shards of glass from when the windshield passed through the windshield that cut JFK in the face. They weren't obvious, but when they began to leak embalming fluid, he patched them with wax. Then we had, of course, after the Greer pulled the limousine to the left and to a halt to make sure JFK would be killed, which, by the way, occurred further down than is generally understood, much closer in relation to the concrete steps leading up to the pergola. You can see in the yellow the three shots fired from the Dal Techs, two of which missed, one of which hit the curb and injured the distant bystander James Tague, another of which hit the comb strip above the windshield, and the third of which hit JFK in the back of the head. Then you can see the red line from the grassy knoll, easiest shot, but no doubt would have injured Jackie. They were under strict instruction she should not be harmed. So the shooter pulled his shot, and it wound up in the grass where it was picked up by a detective. And then if you look at the orange lines, notice in between the orange lines and the yellow lines are the sniper's lair on the sixth floor of the book depository, from which no shots were fired. But while none were fired from there, instead the acoustical impression was created of three shots having been fired from that vicinity by making the Mannlicher Carcano used in the Dal text the only unsilenced weapon. But from the opposite side of the building, three shots were fired at John Connolly in the mistaken belief that was Ralph Yarborough. Lyndon Johnson had a huge fight with LBJ that morning, trying to get Connolly out and Yarborough in. But Jack overrode him on the ground that the chief executive of the state should ride with the chief executive of the United States. And therefore, Connolly wound up being seriously wounded, which obfuscated the politics of the situation, because no one would have imagined Lyndon Johnson would have placed his own campaign manager from 1960 in the path of bullets. But that's how it played out. When Jack overrode him, it was too late to get the word out to the shooters. And since we have four shots in JFK alone, David Mandy wants to suggest there may possibly have been a fifth. We have at least three misses: the chrome strip, the grass, the curb near Tague, the grass opposite the grassy knoll, and then this additional shot. That's four misses. That's already eight shots. You have at least one to three fired at Connolly. That's actually 9, 10, or 11. So when we take into account the additional shot, for which there is evidence for every one of these, how can DiEugenio be so naive as to want to dispute me on the number of shots? I already began investigating that in Assassination Science by the method of addition and subtraction, pointing out evidence for the number of shots we have. And it even appears to be more, because if David's right and there actually was a fifth shot to the head, then there could have been as many as 12. you had the original four hits plus a fifth to the head. Then you had the four misses. That's already nine. And then you got 10, 11, and 12, the three shots fired at John Connolly in the mistaken belief that it was Ralph Yarbrough. I say, Di Eugenio, for God's sake, man, if you want to criticize my work, get serious about it. You have to understand my work, and you have to come to grips with it. You have been so slovenly here, it's embarrassing. The necessity to squander all this time and effort to explain all these claims of yours are completely hopeless, indefensible, and wrong. I did publish on six JFK shooters, including three tied to the CIA named, who did not include Lee Oswald, which I explained to the Santa Barbara Independent. Anyone who wants can go through it. The first shot that hit, which struck Kennedy in the back, appears to have been fired from the top of the county records building by Dallas Deputy Sheriff Harry Weatherford. He used a .30-06 to fire a Mannlicher Carcano bullet fitted with a plastic collar known as a sabot, which hit JFK 5.5 inches below the collar, below the shoulder, just to the right of the spinal column. This was a shallow wound with no point of exit. Number two, Jack Lawrence, a U.S. Air Force expert who had gone to work for the automobile dealership that provided vehicles for the presidential motorcade just a few days before the assassination, fired the shot that passed through the windshield and struck JFK in the throat from the south end of the Triple Underpass. As I've explained, a man named Jim Lewis has gone through junkyards in the south and fired high-velocity rounds through the windshield to see if he could hit dummies in the back seat. He was not only able to do that, but discovered that the bullet passing through creates a small white spiral nebula with a dark hole in the center and makes the sound of a firecracker as it creates that hole, which, of course, corresponds to many of the witnesses who reported that the first shot sounded different than the others, that it sounded like a firecracker. Three, Nestor Tony Escadro, an anti-Castro Cuban recruited by the CIA, fired the shot that JFK in the back of the head after the limousine was brought to a halt. He fired three shots with two misses using a Mannlicher Carcano, which were the only unsilent shots fired from the Dow Tech's building, which housed the uranium mining corporation, Dallas Uranium and Oil. That was a CIA front. And if you go to Little Havana in Miami, you find that there's a statue to Nestor Tony Escadro, even though he's such an obscure figure. There is a statue to the man who liberated Cuba from Spanish domination. But if somebody who's in the know, if you ask why there's a statue to Nestor Tony Escadro, he'll tell you because he took care of business. Fourth, Roscoe White, a Dallas police officer with ties to the CIA, fired from the grassy knoll adjoining the motorcade route, but seems to have pulled his shot, Fetzer said, because it would have hit Jackie. So his shot went into the grass. His son subsequently discovered his diary, but gave it to the FBI and has not been seen since. Five, Malcolm Mack Wallace, who shot from the Dallas Book Depository, may have murdered a dozen people for Lyndon B. Johnson. Mack appears to have fired from the west side of the Book Depository at Texas Governor John Connolly in the mistaken belief he was Senator Ralph Yarbrough, whom LBJ despised. Wallace's fingerprint was found on one of the boxes in the assassin's lair in the Book Depository from which Oswald allegedly fired, which, of course, indicates that he helped to set up the assassin's lair. Walt Brown was very emphatic about announcing the fingerprint identification. Di Eugenio seems to have no respect for evidence or research whatsoever. There's ample reason to believe that Mack Wallace was one of the shooters, which was substantiated by Billy Saul Estes in his book modestly entitled A Texas Legend, where he explained how he'd had conversations with Mack Wallace and with LBJ's chief administrative assistant, whom he sent down to Dallas to make sure all the arrangements were in place for the assassination. He had conversation with them before and after the assassination and became convinced they were both deeply involved in setting up Jack Kennedy for the assassination. Six, Frank Sturgis, later complicit in the Watergate robbery, who also appears to have been connected to the CIA, is said by Fetzer to have fired from the north end of the Triple Underpass, the shot that entered Kennedy's right temple. Sturdish is known to have ties to Meyer Lansky, a notorious crime syndicate kingpin, and confessed his role to a New York City Gold Shield detective when he was arrested attempting to kill Marita Lorenz. The detective, whom I know personally, explained to me how when Sturgis came to New York to kill Marita so she could not testify before the House Select Committee on Assassinations, he took him into custody when he entered her apartment, put a .38 up to his head, gave him the throwaway line, said, "Nice shooting," where Sturgis explained to him, James Rothschild, that he had shot Kennedy because he was cavorting with women who were spies for other countries, and that he had placed the brigade in jeopardy at the Bay of Pigs, which was a false claim, but with one the CIA fostered and allowed to remain in the minds of those who participated because it deflected responsibility away from them and onto JFK. I have ample evidence for all of these, for all of these suggestions about shooters. They should be treated as hypotheses, empirically testable hypotheses. I do not claim to be infallible about any issue, but I do assert that there's sufficient evidence to support my making those claims. I've made them in public. I've made them repeatedly. I've made them online. I've made them in interviews. I've made them during conferences. Here is an article where I make them again. If anyone thinks that I am wrong, let them come forward and produce evidence as to why they think I am mistaken and how they know. No one to this date has disputed any of my identifications of these six shooters. I thought that was part of our project. It is simply stunning to me who Jim DiEugenio, who has no reason, it would appear, for disputing any of my identifications, nevertheless wants to assail me for attempting to carry the research on the death of JFK to its logical conclusion by identifying not only the sponsors and the facilitators, but the mechanics themselves, their supervisors and planners. Gary.
All right. On his radio program today, Fetzer will often be heard musing as to what some authors and researchers do not want to be a guest on his show. But he says they will go on Seamus Coogan's show, except that Seamus Coogan doesn't have a show. And if you don't mind, I'd like to comment on that. We were talking about Ed Tatro being on Ron Clark's show at the same time as Seamus Coogan. So that just clears that up. All right. Another musing is that he blames the Zionist cabal for obstructing his path into more media markets. A third thing he can't figure out is why he is not invited to more acceptable JFK conferences. That is, those sponsored by people like Cyril Weck and Deborah Conway. All right. The last is not hard to figure out at all. Back in 1998, at a JFK Lancer conference in Dallas, Texas, Fetzer got so
vociferous.
Oops, got to back it up. In his attack on Josiah Thompson, that Deborah Conway decided to spare the audience from more of his rant, and she actually walked over to the wall and disconnected the microphone. After what we know today, Fetzer.
About Jim Fetzer.
Yes. Should fellow all follow her example?
What he doesn't tell you is, yes, Deborah Conway was so upset with me that she not only participated in the conference I organized on the death of JFK in 1999 in Minneapolis, but invited me to co-chair the conferences for Lancer in 2000 and 2001. DiEugenio, do some homework. You're making this up. Yes, I was blindsided by Josiah Thompson with a ridiculous attack. Yes, for some reason, I was unable to complete the joke about, I just didn't complete the joke, but that didn't mean that happened at that time. It had no enduring significance. I don't muse why authors or researchers don't come on my show. I get everyone I want to come on my show. I have terrific guests on my show. Jesse Ventura, Roger Stone, endless others are on my show. Take a look. go on to the check out the real deal, because today I have a 2-hour show on Monday, on Wednesday, and Friday. It's a video show, and every Wednesday for the second hour, we do a new JFK program like the one we're doing today. Seamus Coogan is beneath contempt. I wouldn't have a conversation with Seamus Coogan. I don't even believe he's a real figure, but this is simply absurd. Well, I blame a Zionist cabal for obstructing my path into more popular media markets. Where does that come from? He's pulling that right out of where the sun doesn't shine. And why I'm not invited to more acceptable JFK conferences? Look, I have organized or chaired or co-chaired 5 different national conferences in Minneapolis in 1991, in Dallas in 2000, in Dallas in 2001, and in Duluth in 2003, and then Santa Barbara 2013. I bring the best people to my conferences. There are plenty of shills and frauds out there to go around for conferences that are sponsored by people like Deborah Conway and Cyril Wecht. I have better things to do. Not only do I have the real deal Monday, Wednesday, and Friday as a video show, but I now have a Tuesday and Thursday program on Rents Radio from 8 to 9 p.m. Central Time. So I'm actually on the air 5 days a week. My work, I do many interviews in addition. I'm kept extremely busy. Just today, for example, I did 2 1-hour-and-a-half presentations about the medical evidence in the death of JFK for advanced high school students out in California, where I was picked among all the possibilities to give those presentations. And it was a great pleasure to do so. My plate is full. I am publishing books, 3 books in the last 10 months. Nobody died in Boston either. Nobody died at Sandy Hook. And I suppose we didn't go to the moon either. The Sandy Hook book is 425 pages, has 13 contributors, including 6 PhD, current or retired college professors. We demonstrate conclusively that the school was closed by 2008. That it was a 2-day FEMA drill. We even have the manual, which I included as an appendix, and that no children died, and that it was done to promote gun control. It was too hot. It blew apart the Obama agenda for gun control. It had to be banned. Amazon banned it. I released it for free as a PDF. Everyone can obtain for free. Go to rents.com, for example. Now I published Nobody Died in Boston Either, even longer, more photographs, 440 pages, 350 photographs, proves that it was a charade from the beginning to the end, that the police knew, the Boston Globe knew, that they even stopped 2 priests from going, approaching to the alleged victims to administer last rites, because they knew if the priests arrived there, that would be exposed as a sham. There was no surge of EMTs in Boston, just as there was no surge of EMTs at Sandy Hook. No string of ambulances either place, because these were drills. These were elaborate charades. And I suppose we didn't go to the moon either. Shorter, but absolutely packed with fascinating stuff. If somebody wants to learn about the moon landing or Paul McCartney, the first death of Saddam Hussein, the second death of Osama bin Laden, or the Holocaust, that's a great place to start. And here, a summary overview. Go to Rents. You'll read Jim Fetzer, PhD, Tuesday and Thursday, 5 to 6 Pacific. Jim Fetzer, a former Marine Corps officer, has published widely on the theoretical foundations of scientific knowledge, computer science, artificial intelligence, cognitive science, and evolution and mentality. A magna cum laude graduate of Princeton who majored in philosophy. He earned his PhD in the history and philosophy of science. He has received many awards and forms of recognition for his teaching and scholarship. McKnight Professor Emeritus at the University of Minnesota Duluth. Has also conducted extensive research into the assassination of JFK, the events of 9/11, and the plane crash that killed U.S. Senator Paul Wellstone. The founder of Scholars for 9/11 Truth. His latest books include The Evolution of Intelligence, 2005, The 9/11 Conspiracy, 2007, Render Unto Darwin, 2007, and The Place of Probability in Science, co-edited with the late Ellery Ells of the Department of Philosophy of the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Vince Bugliosi has described his 3 collections of expert studies on JFK as the only exclusively scientific books ever published on the assassination. He is the only scholar to have presented lectures on JFK at Cambridge, Harvard, and Yale. I don't mean ordinary lectures. I mean conspiracy lectures on JFK at Cambridge, Harvard, and Yale. His latest book, Nobody Died at Sandy Hook, now superseded by And Nobody Died in Boston Either, which was his 31st, where the Boston book is his 32nd, was banned by Amazon.com on what appeared to be political grounds to protect the Barack Obama gun control agenda. His radio show, The Real Deal, is now on video with NBC Monday, Wednesday, Friday from 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern Time with more than 140 shows this year. I think we're up to around 180. And he will begin a new talk show with Rents.com in January, Tuesday, Thursday from 8 to 9 p.m. ET to explain the news behind the news that you have not heard from the mainstream. The show is entitled The Raw Deal. Go to RentsRadio.com and look for the author archives and you can hear the shows. For more on his research, especially James Henry Fetzer, Wikipedia, the free encyclopedia, busted, because after I had participated in a conference on academic freedom, in which we use JFK, 9/11, and the Holocaust as our illustrations, Wikipedia gutted my website and took out all the research on conspiracy theories. But I had kept a recent copy of it, and you can find it compared with the alternative there. James Henry Fetzer, Wikipedia, the free encyclopedia, busted. Here's a photograph from a wonderful evening I spent in the company of Jesse Ventura and Vince Bugliosi, Di Eugenio. So far as I can see, you have everything wrong. You have made no important point. If you ever want to address any of these issues again, I will invite you onto my show and we can have a debate in public. As far as I'm concerned, this has been a laborious exercise demonstrating the truth of the maxim that it's easy to lie and be complex to explain why what you're being told is false and a distortion of the truth. Gary.
We're going to have to call it there. It's a technical knockout. They're dragging him out the ring. All right, Dr. Fetzer. It's just, it was painful to watch. It was just a bloody lamb bashing, so... we're just going to have to drag him out the ring on a stretcher, Dr. Fetzer. Good job. And we'll be on to more JFK next week. This has been the new JFK show, number 96. We thank very much Chance George in the engineer's chair once again. And we'll see you next week. Good job, Dr. Fetzer, but that was pretty brutal.
Hi, my name's Gary King, and I've assembled the most formidable JFK team on planet Earth. We've got Dr. James Fetzer, Larry Rivera, who is the number one researcher in the world today when it comes to new research. And we've got Don Fox, who's not afraid to look a little bit deeper than anyone else. So if you're interested in what happened to the 35th president of the United States, then I invite you to our show. It's called The New JFK Show, and it's on YouTube. Go to Gary King YouTube channel. And we've got over 90 shows archived for you there. So if you really want to know the truth, and knowing that over 9 out of 10 researchers are working the other side of the street in a sea of disinformation, I pledge to you the truth about JFK. Go to Gary King YouTube channel and find out your true history.